Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Gordon H. Nick Mueller, founding president and CEO emeritus of the National World War II Museum. His new book is Preserving the Legacy, Creating the National World War II Museum. It is such an honor to welcome Gordon Nick Mueller, the founding president and CEO emeritus of the National World War II Museum, back to The Reading Life. Before he began his work at the museum, Nick enjoyed a 33-year career as a professor of history here at the University of New Orleans. His books include Everything We Have, 6644, for the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and last year's Building the National World War II Museum, written with Callie Martin Schick. And now he's back with the definitive history of the museum, Preserving the Legacy, Creating the National World War II Museum, with a foreword by Tom Brokaw. Nick, I'm so happy to welcome you back with this book.
Well, I'm happy to be here, especially since it's my old home here in the University of New Orleans, and I always feel good when I'm on campus. So,
well, good. Nothing changes here at WWNO, obviously.
Well, when I was vice chancellor, it was under me, too, so it's a double home.
Now, I love that you have your origin story completely in place for the National World War II Museum, when you and historian Steve Ambrose first cooked up this idea. So remind us of that story.
Well, it was a typical afternoon, either in his house or mine, and we always got together and drank cheap sherry at 5 o'clock, because I was administrator and he was professor and teaching, and so we'd cook up our schemes and ideas. And that day he said, look, I got an idea, you know, let's sit down. You're gonna like this. And so anyway, we're gonna start a small museum, D-Day Museum, in the research park that you're in charge of developing right now. And I've got, I of course knew that because I helped him set up the Eisenhower Center 6 years earlier. He was recording all these histories for D-Day veterans. And he says, these are gold. I'd heard a lot of them. And boy, I knew that. And he says, so I'll donate these oral histories, put them in this new museum, and that will ensure that they're always preserved and added to as we go along. And we can celebrate Andrew Higgins, who built the boats that Eisenhower said won the war. And you've got free land there right where Higgins tested those boats. So, and he says, Congress has told me, people up there that are friends, I've begged them to do a museum on D-Day or World War II. They said, not going to happen, Steve. Not going to have, as much as we love you. So he said, screw them. Let's do it right here.
He can hear him.
The Higgins story is of course the clincher, because in the research park and the free land. But we had done a lot of things together, both on campus and off campus. So, and then of course he only thought it would be. He said, "Good, it's only going to cost $1 million." Ah, I said, "Steve, you're so naive about these things. It's going to be at least $4 million." Well, I missed a few zeros.
That's right.
And it was not the lakefront. It ended up downtown.
And it is not small.
It's not small. It's beyond anything either of us dreamed or imagined.
I was watching some of the footage from the Memorial Day observances, and it struck me what a photogenic museum that is. How everybody is drawn into the aesthetic experience of it. It is a very beautiful place to see.
It's strong and beautiful and bold all at the same time. And the architect who came up with that master plan thought about the parade ground and how, in military terms, traditionally, parade grounds brought communities together as well as the military. And that architecture was very difficult to design exhibits in, but it is really beautiful and welcoming and warm. And it's just spectacular.
It is. Now, I can't imagine that you two ever thought of anything small, a small museum, really, without knowing somehow it would grow to expand the space available in your lives. So here we are, and it's the leading attraction. It's unique in the world, don't you think?
It is. I must say so myself. We didn't think it'd be unique in the world. We thought it would be unique as a D-Day museum in out here in the lake or in New Orleans, only because nobody had ever done a museum devoted to a single day in history. I mean, that was a very captivating, alluring idea from the first drink, as we said. I mean, it was powerful, compelling, one of the great battles in Western history. 1066 comes to mind, William the Conqueror, Battle of Marathon, 490 B.C. So it ranks right up there with that. Yes, we imagined pretty quickly, had some advisors before we had a board, and we got an architect to help us and exhibit designers on contract. And they said, you know, it's going to be at least $15 million. It's going to be, you know, bigger than $4 million would pay for. And, you know, so we were looking at about maybe 30,000 square feet or something like that at that time. And that was only a year or two afterwards. So, and well before, 3 years before we moved downtown. But yeah, it just grew kind of incrementally. And of course, then we bought the warehouse downtown.
Yeah.
That was already 80,000 square feet. So all of a sudden it got a lot bigger. But, by that time, the exhibits were growing, too.
The great thing about this book is that it's suspenseful to read. It's exciting to read because you're seeing this vision grow along with the people who came up with it. And you're seeing how dramatic it was, how much work it took, how many close calls you had. You know, so what were some of the high points for you?
The book is really three or four stories in one.
Absolutely.
And the reason it's suspenseful is because there was a lot of suspense and drama along the way. So my challenge was going back to the records and recreating and recollecting with the records and board minutes and newspapers and every way I could to see is my memory is the tension and the drama the same as I remember it. Because at various times, especially when I became involved in 98, the stakes were very high. There are a lot of uncertainties. So the story is really about why we did it, what we did, how we did it. And overlaying all of that is my own personal story is kind of embedded in all three of those. And there was drama in all three.
Absolutely.
The why, the how, and the what. And it was a challenge, especially for me. It wasn't something that I ever thought I was going to be leading until 1998. I mean, I was on sabbatical. I was in the drop program, so I was going to be retiring in 2002. I just entered. I was on sabbatical, going back to teach. I had a lot of personal, professional plans all worked out.
Yeah.
It was 50-50. I mean, I wonder often, what if I had said no? I mean,
exactly.
I came close. I mean, it took me 5 months to agree. And of course, nobody else wanted to do it then. We were broke again. So why am I taking this on? You know, even the newspaper, I think James Varney wrote a story that I still remember in 98 that he says, after 94, there was great optimism about the museum. We had a movie. We were off to Normandy for the 50th with Tom Brokaw. We briefed President Clinton. And he says, but then it's like the German machine guns were strafing the project for the next 3 years. But now he says there's a little ray of optimism.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nick Mueller, founding president and CEO emeritus of the National World War II Museum. His new book is Preserving the Legacy, Creating the National World War II Museum. Now, the secret to your success, as you tell it in this thing, is that you committed all your energies to a common purpose, and you called out, I think, the best in everyone you chose to work with. Mm-hmm. You tried to find the best people. You tried to bring out the best in them. And I think so much of it is due to your inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of startup programs here at the University of New Orleans, but nothing on that scale. So I had learned something about management, leadership, risk-taking. You know, neither Steve nor I knew a damn thing about museums. And so, but we did come to it with a strong intellectual sense of what a museum could be or should be. And it's not that far different from teaching or taking students to Europe for mm-hmm. summer schools or transforming people who come to the university to learn. And there was some great teaching here. I wrote something in my preface, just a sentence, and this comes from my own kind of intellectual background. Mm-hmm. History, like art, is concerned with the performance of factual content. The best history museums tell stories visually. In addition to historical records, they rely on art and design to move the audience to the heart of the historical experience, to make it personal, meaningful, and authentic. The National World War II Museum aspires to the highest levels of that performance. Mm-hmm. Now, that comes from a historian and my own desire to transform lives in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And it's had a profound evolving awareness in my own intellectual journeys from graduate school through the universities. And it came into play as I designed exhibits that would inspire and that would transform people and move people. And so when you remove yourself from the classroom, any vision you're trying to execute, you really have to bring people together around the understanding that experience mm-hmm. has to be meaningful and authentic, and you have to bring all the visuals and all the history and the documents together in a very simple, powerful way to create that experience.
And the educational mission is something you and Steve were really uniquely positioned to think about in new ways mm-hmm. because of these oral histories, and to expand in great ways, too. I think, personally, I feel so lucky the National World War II Museum is here because I've gotten to talk to these great historians who've come to speak, who came for the conference on World War II. I mean, it's educated me in a really profound and wonderful way. I feel very lucky that way.
Well, it's become a magnet to historians and government leaders and politicians, senators, congressmen, business leaders. Everybody gravitates toward this museum, and everybody has a different experience. It's individual and personal to them, and mm-hmm. it takes you deeper than you might imagine. You know, most people go to a museum. I do. Most of the ones I go to, maybe I spend a couple of hours. But I tell people, this is going to draw you in. Be careful if you haven't got enough time, because you're going to want to come back if you don't spend 4 or 5 hours.
Don't think you're going to zip in and out of this museum. But some of the stories that you tell in this book, I'm very moved by the restoration of the Higgins boat. Of course, I have a friend who worked on that boat, and it was a transformative experience for her. When you describe getting some of the aircraft, tell us some of those stories.
Every aircraft was a wonder and a miracle that we got. And we knew we wouldn't have time for more space for more than 5 or 6 iconic aircraft. The first one was the British Spitfire that was bought actually in 97. And that was before we even had the building open. And bought by Pat Taylor at auction in our behalf. We paid for it. He restored it. But it was the pilot whose plane, his Spitfire, flew over the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, and he has it recorded in his log.
Wow.
And then we got it, and that pilot knew we had it, and he was here at the opening ceremonies. Can you believe?
It gives me goosebumps.
Yeah. I was talking at the opening with Steve at the press conference, and the deputy director calls me and he says, do you think you'd like to meet the pilot who flew that plane? And I said, yeah. He says, he's right up here on the balcony with me.
Whoa.
We didn't even know he was coming. I mean, that stuff, things like that happen. The other one that's interesting was, we were looking for a C-47 from World War II, an authentic one. There were 5,000 or so still flying around the world, different places after World War II. But we heard there was one on eBay. I was sailing in the British
Virgin.
On eBay. And my director of collections calls me up as I'm getting off my sailboat and fly home. And he says, it's on for $250,000. I said, we don't have any $250,000. And he says, yeah, but he says, I think we ought to bid on it because the provenance tracks it through Sweden and New England, and it was being restored in Texas, and he wants to sell it. And I said, put in a bid for $4,000 more, and I'll find the money in a week. I said, because we had to have the cash.
Yeah.
And I did. And it was Paul Hilliard from Lafayette who had was coming on the board, but he wasn't. And I called him because he wanted us to get planes. And so we bought it on eBay.
Well, I love that description of you holding your breath when the plane gets hoisted up in the air.
That P-17.
I'm not sure.
It went up about 3 feet off the floor, 4 feet, and it stopped with a big jerk, and those wings just bounced and bounced. And I thought to myself, oh my God, here goes $2 million going to be crashing to the floor. It's only 4 feet off the ground.
But it worked.
it settled down.
That was very dramatic.
It was dramatic. We were all watching and holding our breaths.
One of the things that interests me so much in institutions like this is the idea of stewardship. That you know it's only yours for a little while, mm-hmm. and you have to make sure that its future is secure.
Yep.
And you seem to feel really good about that, which must be wonderful.
I do. I do feel very good about it. I knew about 2013, 2014, and it's in the book, that by 2017 or so, it was going to be need for me to retire. I was going to be 77 or 8 at that time, and the operations were already, we had 200 or 300 people working for us, and plus catering and projects and fundraising, and I said, and the money for most of the buildings was in view or in place. We were building mm-hmm. the campaign's pavilion, and so picking my successor, I had a chance to influence that with the board, and Stephen Watson was my recommendation. It took about 5 years to kind of move it slowly through until I was ready to announce my retirement. But he was doing a lot of things that I was getting credit for, so I thought, I said, if you really need the continuity of someone, he's not a historian, he's a businessman, but he understands the story, the veterans, he understands the mission, and he can execute, and he can get the rest of the money that we need to finish this. Mm-hmm. And I need to write some books. So
I said,
great
story.
So, yeah.
Great, great story. I'm curious what your favorite place in the museum is.
The library. It's the crown jewel, you know. No, but of the exhibits.
What do you like to watch people see for the first time, you know?
Well, I like to watch people in the when they first come into the Louisiana Pavilion, where uh-huh. the entrance area is, and there's so much to engage people of all ages. They're looking around. They're trying to get their tickets. The volunteers are talking to them. The Higgins boat is there. The planes, a couple of planes are hanging above them. There's the big media wall up there, and people know this place is buzzing.
Yeah.
This is exciting. This is adventurous. I mean, even the young kids are, you know, their mouths are open and they're looking around, And then they enter the exhibits, and the exhibits are all kind of an adventure, you know, with the environmental exhibits and the media, which attracts young people, the dog tag experience, which brings up the personal stories of the guys. If you're in the D-Day exhibits, you're hearing the guys who are climbing the cliffs or getting off the Higgins boats, and they're telling you what went through their mind as they were approaching the shore in the face of the battle with the Germans triaging their machine guns on those boats in the killing fields of bloody Omaha. So you get right into the personal stories and the artifacts that tell those stories. And so I think that it's exciting. I'll tell you, about 2 months ago, I was in the restrooms of the by the American sector, and there was a young man about 32, and he was washing his hands, and he looks up to me. He says, "Have you been to this place before?" I said, "Don't you think it's great?" And I said, "Oh, man, I think it's great." He said, "I do, too. I can't wait to get back out there." And I said,
"Oh, wow."
I said, "This is real." He just kind of discovered I didn't know anything more about him. He just walked out the door.
Volunteered. That is fantastic.
Yeah, it was great. So, I mean, he didn't know who I was.
Sure.
You know, and he just thought I was another tourist.
Little did he know.
So, yeah, it's been amazing. There are a lot of moments like that in the museum.
Well, and with the veterans themselves,
too,
really meaningful personal moments, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're fewer and fewer of those, you know.
Yeah.
We had 6 million when we opened. We're down to less than 200,000 still living today. They're all 9,900, most of them.
Are you concerned with the general climate of things today about museums and how the government's looking at them these days?
Well, yeah, I'm very concerned. One thing is we're not a government-funded operation like the Smithsonian's. They've already been told they'd remove some of the images and artifacts and from the museums. I understand some of those got put back, but it's a pretty heavy hand to intrude on the academic freedom of a history institution or an art museum of any kind. So, in a way, we're liberated by our independence as a nonprofit. After Katrina, we all thought maybe we ought to give this museum to the government and let them designate us as a Smithsonian. That got to be very complicated, but the best thing we ever did was not do that. And to continue as an independent nonprofit. So it's a concern, and I'm not sure that everybody today would concur with our interpretation of the legacies of World War II and what's kept us out of war for the last 80 years, and benefits in terms of education and civil rights and women's rights, and how we rebuilt nations that we had just defeated. We had another enemy in the Cold War, of course, our former ally, the Soviet Union. But by and large, there's more advances in freedom, democracy, and human rights as a result of Allied victory in World War II because of American leadership than any time in human history. Now, that was true up until about 5 or 10 years ago. So there are isolationist impulses like there were, a very strong isolationist movement in the 30s. We wanted to stay out of war. We wanted to withdraw. But World War II made America a global superpower. And we are therefore all over the world. We are interconnected with the world economically, socially, culturally, by the people that come here, that trade with us, the people that we reach out to. But all we can do as historians is document the past.
Yeah.
And we can say America's leadership around the world for 80 years has been stellar. It has changed countries. It has lifted people from poverty. It has brought food to the hungry. And it has created a world of stability, relatively so, compared to between World War I and World War II, which was peace for only 20 years.
The last time I interviewed Steve Ambrose was September 11th, 2002. And we talked about books he'd written and books he hoped to write. And he said that he knew one thing, that he and Nick Mueller could write a hell of a book about how to build a museum. We've been talking with Nick Mueller, who has indeed written that book, Preserving the Legacy, Creating the National World War II Museum. You can meet Nick Thursday, June 5th, at a book launch from 4:30 to 6:30 at the National World War II Museum. Nick, congratulations on this fine book, and thanks for all you do for our city.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The big event this week is the Symphony Book Fair at Lakefront Arena. There's an admission charge Saturday, May 31st from 9 a.m. to 1, then free admission Saturday from 1 to 6, then Sunday from 9 to 4. There are books in more than 50 categories and children's books, art, music, and games. New York Times bestselling author Vaishnavi Patel discusses her novel, 10 Incarnations of Rebellion, with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Monday, June 2nd at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Tickets are encouraged. M.A. Nicholson hosts NOLA's new book roundup, Monday, June 2nd at 7 at Bar Redux. Featured writers this month are Constance Adler, Chris Champagne, Ariel Francisco, Benjamin Morris, Brad Richard, Vanessa Saunders, Andy Young, and Rachel Zavix. Howard Phillips Smith discusses and signs George Valentine Duroux, Art and Life in New Orleans, Friday, May 30th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Saturday, May 31st at 3 at Arthur Roger Gallery. Gordon Nick Mueller discusses and signs Preserving the Legacy, Creating the National World War II Museum, Thursday, June 5th from 4:30 to 6:30 at the National World War II Museum. Three local authors, Constance Adler, author of Sight Unseen, Allison Alsop, author of Foreign Seed, and Teresa Tuminello Brader, author of Secret Keepers, discuss their new books Thursday, June 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.